Interesting story in the news. Lots of interesting stories, of course. But it's the comments from, and I'm really interested in what you all think, especially given the fact that we have one of the greatest mixes of residential property and holiday homes in the country. So Tom Gilligan, he's Director of Services for Housing and Roads in Mayo County Council. He has urged people to boycott the owners of holiday homes this summer. He sent an email to members of the local authority committee last week urging the community to boycott, literally holiday home owners. And what do you think about that? He says that they should be sort of like, not protested against, but that they should be called out by the local community. So what do you think? What do you think about that? He says they're bad neighbours. Tom Gilligan claims such properties are a luxury we can't afford amidst the housing crisis. So, like, this is an official in a local authority who is effectively turning, or seeking to turn, it seems, and the words, whether he intends it or not, to turn people against, you know, effectively their neighbours, albeit them part-time neighbours. Like, that's, what do you think of that? I'm trying to not sort of express too much of my own opinion, but it's only last week we had Micheál Martin that was calling out local authorities for rattling the begging bowl too much to provide housing with central government funding. He believes they should be doing more on the ground. They should be spending the resources to turn vacant properties around very, very quickly. Like, your copybook would have to be pretty clean, I think, in a position as a senior county council manager to suggest that the general public should boycott the owners of holiday homes. So are we supposed to, if they come into the local bar or local shop, turn our backs to them, walk away? Like, what exactly is he suggesting? He believes that this is one of the ways we could fix the housing crisis. Let me know what you think. 086 60 25,000. Do you agree with him? Or do you think this is a bit of an overreach? I'll try and get the full quotes from him, but some of the remarks. Now, the defence is being used that boycott is a... that boycott is a male word and maybe has some sort of a different kind of a context. I don't know. But anyway, he seems to be of the view that we should be boycotting our people coming in here. I'll just read some more of what he said. Mr. Gilligan proposed the immediate boycott of holiday homeowners in Mayo as a potential remedy for bringing holiday homes back into use for long-term sustainable housing. Referencing the historic significance of Mayo through the Land League and name-checking Michael Davitt, Captain Boycott, Charles Stuart Parnell and Mahatma Gandhi, Mr. Gilligan called for grassroots action. While policy tools such as taxation and CPOs are progressing, grassroots action in the form of a targeted boycott is also being proposed as a way to express community dissatisfaction and create pressure for change, he said. Under the headline, Application of the Boycott, he said it would be a peaceful, non-violent civil action. He said a four-point plan would involve local community in which holiday home owners live part-time, avoiding patronage of businesses or services owned by absentee landlords, refusing engagement with holiday home owners, public campaigns, protests and community meetings encouraging social solidarity, social pressure, including open letters and local resolutions demanding accountability for property investors. So effectively, really, looking to round up locals to turn on holiday makers. What do you think about that? Do you think that he's off the mark, or maybe you think he's spot on? I'm not making up that language. That's quite literally the language he used himself. I'm quoting there from the email. He wants the locals to turn against the holiday home owners. Okay, we're going to be talking about the future of our post offices right now, actually. Finola McBride, General Treasurer for the Irish Postmasters Union. I won't keep you long, so we'll get straight to the point, Finola. You are saying the post office needs, the network needs €15 million per year over 5 years. And this is this to maintain services or to improve and grow?
Good morning, Greg. Thank you for having me. The question you're asking me, yes, we're looking for $15 million over a five-year period, and that's basically to stabilise the existing post office network that we have already. As you know, I'm in Castlefin, and we provide an essential service to our local communities. And as most people would know, we just don't do more than just selling stamps, okay? We provide service to people, that everyday service, that is something that you wouldn't get in most places in this day and age. We have face-to-face communication with our customers. We help them, we fill out forms, and this work basically goes unpaid. Now, three years ago, the government allocated $30 million to the post office network, which would have been $10 million over a three-year period. Now, Greg, that is running out now in December. And what we're looking for now is the government to invest $15 million, not to expand the business, but about safeguarding our post offices. We want to prevent closures, and we want to have certainty for our future. So that's why we're looking for this investment for the next 5 years.
Yeah, and there was a battle, really, as opposed to make the argument of what post offices can provide and what they can mean to local communities, going back over the years, Fionnuala. This is really about the government recognising the role of the post office network. Do you think they do? Because unless they do, these calls are going to fall on deaf ears.
No, as they do recognise the work that we've been doing, and we have been told that they will invest money, but at this minute we don't know what they're going to give us. So no, they know the work that we do. We have their support. I'm in Boswell's Hotel now today, and at 10:30 we're launching our Grant Thornton report to the ministers and TDs to let them know why we need the $15 million. And to get that starting in 2026 for the next 5 years.
What will you be looking from them? Obviously, you want them to hear you, right? But will you be looking for some commitments to sort of say, right, OK, we take on board what you're saying. We're going to roll in behind you on this one.
Yeah, well, we would like them. We've asked them for more work. We're available for more work. Like, for example, we as postmasters would be able to become peace commissioners. Now, that would take off the work off the guards, for example. And we could do that because we know everybody. So that'd be one role we could do for the government. We would like to be able to do public services cards, where rather than people having to travel to their nearest office, that they could come into the post office, we know them, and be able to do the cards. That would save time and money. There's other things that we could do, like we've always wanted the motor tax, and we still lobby for that. We would love to have that. Not a day goes by that I'm not asked for the motor tax. We would like to do download forms, because we get a lot of forms from the government every year. Sometimes then that they go out of date and have to be recycled. We could save the government money there by just downloading the form and printing them off for the customer as we go along. Mm. So there is things out there that we want to do, even to do electoral for customers as well, registering people. And it's just what we've asked the government. They're looking into their areas to see what they can give us. Mm. So
you're offering services in return for further investment to, I suppose, provide better services to the public, but make the network more viable. And you talk about like something simple as motor tax. You know yourself, people are not happy that now there are, you know, limited days where you can go in person and do that type of business. And you're saying the network's there. Why not avail of it?
Absolutely. Like we are a business, and we can't, as I don't know if people realise, but you know, we can't increase any prices on any of the products that we sell, because it's set by ANPOST. So you know, we provide the service like banking. We do all AIB banking, Bank of Ireland. We do the ANPOST banking, and we provide that service, and that prevents people having to travel. For me, people have to travel to Balbuffet and the extended area of Castlefin. That's like a 34-kilometre round trip. So it's vital that we don't close, that we're able to provide these services for customers, because not everybody's digitalised, you know, into computers or into.
But it's not always age-related either. Some people prefer to be able to deal that way. You know, often I think you and I know, but often people think that it's a generational thing. But there's people throughout all generations. Listen, you've that thing at 10:30. I'm not going to hold you up, Fionnuala. Yes. You made the points very well. Thank you very much indeed. Take care. That's General Treasurer for the Irish Postmasters Union and Donegal postmaster, Castlefin postmaster, Finola McBride there. And that launch is taking place down in the Boswell in the next little while. A caller says, yes, Greg, tuned into that freak fest called Eurovision on Saturday night for my last time ever. The only way Ireland will win again is to enter a troupe of dancing nuns, transgender nuns, they say, singing a trash metal version of Ave Maria, Bring Back Dana and Johnny Logan. Presumably not as transgender nuns. I'm very angry and even confused, says another, that Israel almost again won a contest they should have been totally excluded from. Israel has committed horrific war crimes and have no intention of stopping until the Palestinian people are wiped out. They should be banned from participating in any civilized activity while the double standards Russia were banned immediately. Why not Israel? Are Palestinian lives less valuable than Ukrainian ones? Why does the entire world seem to be afraid of Israel? Big, big question. And don't even speculate about that because you might be called anti-Semitic or something along those lines. Unfortunately, they have, not unfortunately, that is the defence that it's quite difficult to even talk about things because if you say that anything that's sort of anti, you could be... called out on that. Okay, we're very lucky to be able to tap into the experience and opinions of retired consultant orthopaedic surgeon, Dr. Peter O'Rourke. Peter, thanks for your time. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
We were listening earlier on about the ongoing calls for additional haematology services in Letterkenny, people waiting crazy amounts of time and being asked every 4 months if they still need to be seen. What's your take on the situation?
Well, I think we've heard both haematology and oncology in the news locally quite a lot recently, especially with the minister's recent visit. The problem with these services, historically, I was in the hospital and part of the medical management when they brought on oncology services before we even had a haematologist. And these services were supposedly brought on as outpatient services, would have no impact on beds and no impact on the hospital. It would be wonderful for all the people of Donegal to have access to these services, which is true, but they were never funded, they still aren't funded, and they far exceed the resources allocated to them. If you take oncology, I think they have a bed unit. I'm not sure exactly how many it's, but it's sort of 15 to 18 beds. But they usually have, certainly when I was working there, 30 patients plus in the beds. Haematology would also have other patients in the bed. So these services were never properly resourced. So you bring on extra haematologists, extra oncologists, and the knock-on effect is more... patients being brought into hospital, and the only thing that gives is services that previously were the routine service in the hospital get deferred, cancelled or outsourced.
Fundamentally though, this is a hospital that the workload, the footfall, the amount of people through it, it needs to be completely reclassified, does it not, in terms of resources and funding, etc., rather than these occasional battles for a particular consultant in a particular field without really taking the bigger picture into consideration?
Totally. I mean, the hospital needs to be redeveloped. It's not, and each individual group that fights to get what they want is to the detriment of other services. I mean, we had the scandal in the gynecology service, as a result of which massive resources were put into reducing their waiting lists. But again, that was to the detriment of other surgical services. So it's all well and good saying, we're going to do this, we're going to improve waiting times. But you should only be doing it with by putting resources in to allow you to do it without robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Why then is it so difficult to get proper funding for Letterkenny University Hospital, where it's running a deficit many years, let alone sort of, you know, breaking even and looking for more resources for more services? Why is it so, in your view, you know, traditionally underfunded, and in many ways people feel it's going backwards?
Well, it isn't to be considered going backwards. It is going backwards and at a rate of knots. I mean, historically, Letterkenny has always had a larger catchment area than Sligo, but we were all the poor relations to Sligo. Sligo were designated a regional hospital with a catchment area of something like 85,000 when Letterkenny had 120,000. They were always funded. They got more for their 80,000 than we got for our 120,000. They got appointments with consultants who were actually meant to have attachments to Letterkenny. They never set foot in the place. Letterkenny has never had the political will that people like the McSharries pushed an agenda Waterford and Sligo, Letterkenny has always been left behind. And the Letterkenny way was to do things quietly, not jump up and down. And basically that has got us to where we are now. I mean, if you think in terms of when I was appointed, there was four operating theatres. There was three general surgeons, one orthopaedic surgeon before I got there. And now we have, I think, five general surgeons, although not, I think, all in post at the moment, four orthopaedic surgeons, and we have the same number of theatres. I mean, trying to recruit replacements for surgeons is going to be incredibly difficult, because the one thing a surgeon wants to do, especially a newly minted one, they want to operate. They want to do as much surgery as they possibly can. Mm-hmm. But why would anybody come to a place like Letterkenny where you might get to operate every second week if you're lucky?
Yeah.
And so we've got medical beds. We have a medical rehabilitation unit. We have a massive temporary structure for endoscopy. So vast numbers of people have been having their colonoscopies and gastroscopies, but nobody's getting surgery. And the busiest surgical department in the hospital is the NTPF office, which outsources patients to Ballykelly and places like that. And ironically, we now have another private medical unit setting up in Letterkenny, so they've helped people outsource to private hospitals in Northern Ireland. So less will be done in the hospital, more money will be taken out of the health service, and patients will be travelling across the border for procedures that could be done in Letterkenny.
In your view, Peter, someone needs to look at the workload and also the demographic. You know, we have an older population, and really the money's kind of supposed to follow the patient, but I don't think that's really happening in Letterkenny at all. We've got a very skewed population here in terms of those that attend that hospital. So we have a hospital of that size. It's that busy offering these services. Are you familiar with who looks at that and allocates consultants, other staff and other resources? Because my understanding is it's not Sialta, it's certainly not the local hospital manager, and it's not the Minister for Health. Somewhere up the chain, there's someone looking at the situation and saying, I'm not approving that a consultant, or I'm not sending trainees there. You know, something has happened much further up the line that's working to the detriment of Letterkenny University Hospital.
Well, it's like when the minister comes to visit. She has the answers to the questions she's to be asked, but she's briefed by various civil servants. So the minister doesn't actually hear what's said locally. The briefing comes from Sailtha, briefing the Department of Health, and then they or the HSE, and they tell the minister what they want her to hear. So Sailtha has been controlling Letterkenny for years. Decisions aren't made in Letterkenny. They're made in Sailtha down in Galway. For instance, all the clinical directorates are run out of Galway. Half the time, clinical directors don't, certainly in my experience, spend very little time, if ever, visiting Letterkenny. Galway has no interest in what happens up in Donegal, as a result of which anything we try to do has to be rubber stamped by Galway, and it never is, or it happens so slowly that it might as well be ignored.
It's a very frustrating picture, and you know, I'm trying to approach it from a different angle, if you know what I mean, and trying to ascertain where the blockages are. I know there is work ongoing to make the argument for an improved funding package or you know, a model 3.5 or whatever way you want to phrase it. But I mean, those wheels move slowly. Nothing you're seeing now surprises you. You've been flagging this even when you were down there as an outspoken consultant on site, Peter.
I was in my 24, 25 years as a consultant in Letterkenny. I was involved in management, I'd say, for 20 of the 24, 25 years, banging my head off a brick wall, getting absolutely nowhere. The problem is you make the hospital unattractive for certain specialties, and if they die, the hospital dies. Mm. And there's a perfect example not too far away from us in Enniskillen. Enniskillen was built as a state-of-the-art hospital. They've no, as far as I'm aware, acute services there because they couldn't get surgeons, anaesthetists and people like that to work there because it wasn't a job that was worth doing, because you couldn't treat people if you didn't have a group of colleagues that gave you access to intensive care, operating theatres and other specialties to complement your specialty. It just died a death, and then Enniskillen is basically all but turned into a village hospital. And that's the way Letterkenny is going, to be quite honest. And I worry for my own health when I get to the stage where I need services, that they just won't be there.
Okay. Dr. Peter O'Rourke, retired consultant orthopaedic surgeon, thank you so much for your time, as always. A caller says holiday home owners pay property tax, buy local, and are replacing hotels who are housing refugees in Airbnb. We need tourists, so we need holiday homes. The Mayo guys deflecting from the state failures to build houses. Last week, there were calls for the elderly to move to smaller homes. This week, it's holiday home owners. What next? Get rid of cows and house people in byres? yeah, it's not. This is interfering with what people do with their own resources and their own property. I mean, if you comply to everything, all the local rules, the planning rules, absolutely everything, and you work your butt off and you manage to secure yourself a nice little holiday home on the West Coast, to sort of suggest, someone to suggest, especially a council official, to suggest that you should be boycotted, that people should turn their backs on you for that. I mean, that's pitting. And a lot of the people in this county, for an example, might be from Northern Ireland. That's pitting Irish person against Irish person. I find it quite a remarkable intervention. But anyway, I want to question the framing that trans women would make. They call them cis women, but I mean, that's a strange terminology. But anyway, I'll use it because you're using it. I want to question the framing that trans women would make cis women and girls uncomfortable in open swimming pool changing rooms. Most of my trans friends and family would give up swimming rather than find themselves in such a situation. The issue is facilities not thinking about inclusion. Every pool goer deserves privacy when changing. Most modern pools now have individual and family-sized cubicles to facilitate this. It's just an example of some of the places that people have their concerns. I don't be in women's changing rooms, right? So I don't know their layout or what they say. I'm just talking of, I'm just reflecting what you hear some people commenting in. But I mean, It's as opposed to, it's about whether it's exploited or not, not by your friends. Anthony says, so that councillor doesn't see any harm in a transgender female changing in a female changing area in a swimming facility. Well, he never said that. He said that there's no evidence that there is a danger, I believe. I don't wish to misquote him. But that's he says there seems to be no evidence of that, but also recognise that it's a complicated issue. But I mean, I suppose too, you know, like it is worth, and it's Pippa that sent that in, and Pippa, I'd love a response from you. I mean, you know, the way it is in Ireland, you know, maybe some of your trans friends are, maybe they've had gender-affirming surgery, maybe they're taking hormones or what have you. In this country, that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. There are biological males who identify as female that have not done any of that, that are working in childcare settings, that are working and have access to females' facilities. Are you fully comfortable with that as well? Or what? 086 60 25,000. I'm interested in all views and certainly don't want to come anti any community. It's a very small community and I certainly don't want to be doing anything to pile any hate in that regard. But as I say, it is a conversation that's being had. I'm joined on the programme now by Seamus Ryan, who's Industrial Relations Officer with Forsa. Good morning, Seamus. Thank you for your time.
Very welcome, Greg. Thanks for having me on.
Right. Now, in terms of recognition, school secretaries and caretakers, we've been calling, we had been covering this story for years. Some of them were employed in different ways compared to how they might be employed in a different school. Has that situation been resolved now that these people, for the most part, are paid, you know, through by the the education department rather than individual schools?
No, this situation hasn't been resolved yet. We're at a halfway house for our caretaker colleagues and for our secretary colleagues who are a little bit further along. While they're paid by the Department of Education, caretakers still are not, and that's coming down the road in the next little while. There's some things to work out in terms of payment for like use of their own equipment and their own cars to use and vans to do work, call out allowances, things like that, for having the key to come in and turn off an alarm in the middle of the night, that kind of thing. But the big issue is that unlike the other people that work in schools with them, SNAs and teachers, principals of schools, who of course are teachers as well. These people who look like ducks, walk like ducks, quack like ducks are in fact not ducks. They're not public sector workers, and the people they work with side by side have a range of supports and rights that they don't have, namely access to, you know, a state worker pension and things like you know, significant sick leave, critical illness leave. And we believe that after 45 years of looking for this, it's time that these workers were accepted for what they are, public sector workers, and that they've been brought into that fold.
There might be industrial action coming down the line in relation to this. Why are they ducks for the most part, as you mentioned, but aren't receiving a public service pension? What's the argument here? And is it about it being retrospective? Is it about it going forward? What's the hold up?
Well, the argument is, well, this essentially comes from a historical situation where previously, back in 78, 79, and we're going back beyond even my years now at this stage, not many years, but a few years beyond my lifetime, that there was a change to how these staff were employed. And the power was given to schools and local boards of management to put in place their own staff locally, rather than having them centrally employed, where they would have got access to the terms and conditions of employment of public sector workers. And unfortunately, over the years, there's been significant drift between what a clerical officer or a general operative working in an ETB, which are essentially doing the same work in schools, gets paid, has a pension, the terms and conditions of employment, and we want to correct that. We want to bring them back in line with the people that do the same work in the schools around every single county that they look at. And we want them to have access to those securities and the pension that comes with it.
Yeah, and there's nothing them for them at all. There is a ballot ongoing. Is that through FORSA that ballot is ongoing? I think it's up till the June 11th or something along those lines.
Yeah, the ballot opened yesterday for our members, about 2,500 secretaries and caretakers across the country. And that doesn't include people, of course, who work in ETBs, who are another cohort of our staff, those who have, you know, the old scheme, which there are still a couple of hundred across the country. So there's larger membership, but these are the people that are affected. So voting opened yesterday in that ballot, and it'll continue on until the 11th. And from the 11th onwards, we'll have a result, and members and the public and indeed government will know what the result of that is. And of course, we're encouraging secretaries and caretakers to vote in their numbers for this industrial action, this strike action.
This has always been a complex one, but bear with me here. So there was a package offered to secretaries, and the majority took it, I presume, where they become department administered payroll employees effectively, which means they do get holiday pay and what have you. But they're still deemed to be employees of the individual schools, and therefore the department's arguing it is the schools then that should sort out the pension for them. So how is the government, and you're not a government spokesperson or the relevant department, paying them and affording them entitlements through their payroll system, but these people are still employees of the schools for which they work?
Well, the funny part of all this is that teachers and SNAs, whom we also represent as SNAs, are also all employees of the school. And that's the same across every board of management run school in the country. And there's 3,943 schools across the country. A few hundred of those are ETB, which are taken out of this equation. But the vast majority of those are people, where teachers and SNAs work are still employed by those schools. And the department acts as their paymaster, the people that pay their wages, set their terms and conditions, write circulars that cover things like maternity leave, bereavement leave, critical illness. They do all that anyway for them. So what we're saying is that secretaries and caretakers quite soon are to move into that system. So why would it be a case that these two cohorts of employees are treated any differently to these much larger groups in the tens of thousands in terms of SNAs and teachers, whereas we have maybe 4,000 to 5,000 secretaries and caretakers who just want that parity between themselves and the other people.
I understand where you're coming from as a union that represents all, but might this be easier to get over the line if we are talking about those currently employed as secretary and caretakers, or those that might be employed into the future? Because it's still a considerable number. To ask the state then to do this retrospectively, I don't know if a figure has been put on it, but I imagine the numbers could be quite huge. And that's notwithstanding the struggles former secretaries and caretakers might be having through the cost of living, etc. But to ask this to be retrospective, is that not going to complicate the course? Whereas you might get it over the line if you talk about those currently employed and those to be employed into the future.
Well, it's interesting because the Department of Education has actually shown us, and so has the Department of Public Expenditure and National Development and Reform, showed us a model that allows them to do this quite easily. They have a model in place that can do it. The people who were employed as 78, 79 contract employees, secretaries and caretakers at the very, very beginning didn't have access to a pension. They were offered it maybe 2 or 3 years into it, but a lot of people were young at that time. It was back in the 80s. People, you know, we're all going to live forever when we start our jobs. We don't really think about pensions, but a lot of people refused it. But then people, you know, obviously matured, realized that you're going to need some money for your retirement and started looking for it. So FORSA has secured a pension for these people, and it's based on taking the notional amount of money they would have gotten from their lump sum and deducting the notional amount of money that would have been paid every fortnight from your wages for a pension contribution. And that notional of money has been used from accounting purposes in the Department of Education to fund these ongoing fortnightly pensions.
And I suppose
so they've shown us how they can do it.
Yeah, and all the money comes from the same pot, really. So what you'd be actually seeking for, particularly if people are of pension age, is for it all comes from the same pot, the gap between the state pension and what pension they might be entitled to. It's a top-up, really, effectively, because presumably this would be in it, or maybe you're seeking it in addition to the state pension.
Well, for public sector workers, their state pension is already wrapped into
the gap between the two employers
every fortnight when you retire. So what this is doing is looking for the amount of money that, you know, on top of the state pension that would be, you know, the entitlement if they had the opportunity. And this is the important thing. Mm. They've never had the opportunity to make a pension payment.
Okay, so if you are a public service, if you're a person with an interest in this, there is a meeting on Thursday in the Mount Errigal Hotel at 7:30 p.m. where it'll be discussed in more detail. Thank you so very much indeed, Seamus Ryan, Industrial Relations Officer with FORSA. Councillor Patrick McGowan is with me now. Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for your time.
Good morning, Greg. Thank you.
Right, OK. So we learned that controversial pedestrian crossing at the Bank of Ireland Ballybuffet is to be moved to a safer location. There's going to be changes also to the other crossings, as far as I understand. Do you believe this is a case of common sense prevailing?
Yes. Well, at the moment, it's out to public consultation. We were told that about 2 years ago that this was a pilot scheme. We're told that this is stage four. So they had a drop on there on the 14th. The consultation is still open to the 26th, I think it is. And sorry, just to check it to be sure, I think it's still open yet. Yes, on the 26th. So there's plans in the base in Stranraer, and there's also plans in the County House in Everett, so people can call in and see them, or they can go online. But yeah,
this has been reported as being a decision that's been made, but you're saying it's actually still in consultation mode.
Oh, yeah, it's in consultation mode, but this is the proposal coming forward from the TIA. They're actually responding to a lot of representations and radio shows and whatever else that the public have been airing their concerns about. So they are reacting to that. And they
but,
do
Patrick,
propose.
In relation to this, though, you know, I mean, like, from the moment, even before they were finished, you know, there were concerns. It was obvious, anyone driving or anyone using the roads, that this was a pilot, a test of how traffic and pedestrians interact. We all knew it made no sense. If we get through this process with no one, you know, ending up in a wheelchair or dead, we'll have only been lucky. It should never have been piloted like this, surely.
No, you're right. And at the time I looked into it, there was a pilot scheme in Limerick, I think it was, Dublin and Balfaith. The difference where they were out on the approach road, big wide roads with grass, verge and footpaths. The ones in Balfaith and Snarley were town centre, very busy National Primary Road. The other two locations got immediate signage, big yellow signs. We got nothing, absolutely nothing. No advance warning signs, nothing. And you're right, it's 2 years. And, you know, it's no wonder the public sometimes people in charge and authority, like when this kind of thing was allowed to happen. I know a lot of the local engineers and staff in the council were equally as concerned as the public were. It took too long, and even now, like it's gone on nearly 2 years. Saying that, the reports are that nobody has been knocked down or accidents at any of the crossings, while there has been several incidents where people are jaywalking. I see it every day of the week. People are still walking across this busy road on their phones, and they're not even, the crossing could be 2 or 3 metres away. And by the way, a lot of people are still not using crossings the way they should. You're supposed to stop, wait for the traffic to stop and cross. But saying that, these high visibility crossings now, they're going to be raised up.
What do you think of that? What do you think about raising tables? Because obviously,
very important. You see it in a lot of towns. Very. I'll tell you what the problem is. If you're, and you drive yourself, Greg, down through that street many times, if you're driving from Balfaith to Stranraer and the person standing on the left-hand side, you have no problem seeing them. If you come from Stranraer to Balfaith, you have no problem seeing them. The problem is people coming from the opposite side of the road, there's a continuous line of traffic, and before you know, there's somebody standing at your bumper, and you wonder, then you look down and you see the line. So they're going to be raised up. The traffic's going to be kept back. You won't be able to mount them until the traffic in front of you clears off. They were bumper to bumper. I just met a man yesterday with an ice cream. He was standing in the middle of the road looking at me. Lucky I knew they were there, and they were stopped. He stopped, and then they walked on. But when they're raised up, you see them in a lot of towns. There's going to be 8 in total. Some of them are going to be marked with a Pelican flashlight. That's the one near the Bank of Ireland. The rest of them are going to be what they call high visibility, raised up in these big yellow signs. The one thing I would ask for, both within Balfaith and Order, Letterkenny, the whole county and the whole of Ireland, we need a bit of consistency. You should have the same crossings everywhere.
As far as you're aware, there's going to be 8 of these raised platforms when travelling through Balfaith and Order.
Yeah, but and look, a lot of them are there at the moment. You think it's a lot, but like it's a long, long time or town because if you take the Bank of Ireland down to Garda Station, further down, there's
it's a long run. It's a long run. There's no doubt about it.
It's a long run, and the people crossing everywhere. Look, the people are going across. As I say, at the moment, they'll not even cross on the ones that are there. People just go from A to B straight across the road.
Yeah, but I mean, they were never given half a chance. If proper pedestrian crossings or what these proposals were put in 2 years ago, people wouldn't feel they have to.
Do you think so, Greg?
I hope so.
You're on the road as much as me. Well, and look, yeah, people walk across.
I also run across roads.
There'll be no excuse when they're done right. But look, it's going to take another few months and gone. And will they be done next year? Probably the next year by the time that they get this done, because the consultation's going on for the 26th of June. As they go to the department,
Someone sent in a press release saying the new walkway between Carrigart and Downings was going to start in August. I'm not even touching that. I've done too many of those stories. I don't want to mislead people. When I see a digger in a field, I'll talk about it then. It's the same with these crossings in Ballymacrae, Stranraer. We often talk about the 10T in the context of, you know, Letterkenny and the relief road, but listen, Ballymacrae and Stranraer must be one of the longest waiting towns for a bypass in the country. I can't imagine there's many behind Ballybofane Stranola in terms of So what is the status? I mean, are compulsory purchases ongoing? Has the route's obviously been identified? Is it all just still coupled as part of the overall 10T and will progress as work in Letterkenny does?
Yeah. The 10T is the three parts, the Letterkenny Bridge, the road from Manor to Lifford, and remember, a lot of people forget about it, the bridge across to Staban, that is, nobody talks about that, but that's part of it, and the Ballybofane. At the moment, the three projects are one. They're now with the Mort Manala, the final designs, the decision is going to them now. The government, the department, the TAA, the National Transport Authority, all have looked at it. They're okay. This is one of the 50 in the country that's definitely going to progress. Now, will we ever get it? That's another question, but it is progressing. And we're hoping now at the end of the year that all the names of all the landowners, Letterkenny, Lifford, Ballybofane, will be published. There is a fear and a lot of concern and a lot of lobbying going on trying to take one project and put it ahead of another. I know my Letterkenny colleagues have been at that for a long, long time, trying to
be
push.
No harm, but it'd be no harm for Letterkenny to get a fair crack of the whip for once. Everything goes to Ballybofane, Stranola, Patrick. Do you know, and to be honest with you, I think the people at Letterkenny deserve a chance.
Yeah, they do. They do, surely.
All right, chat to you in a bit.
Good luck, Greg. Right.
Councillor Patrick McGowan there. A caller says, please... I've just asked that question. It's exactly why I asked it, because I saw it there. Another caller says, I disagree with you about the crossing. Due care and attention should be given by the driver, who the onus is on to drive safely. Do you travel through Ballybofane Stranola a lot? What do you think about eight raised platforms? It should make it safer, but I mean, drivers too, obviously, going to have to go boom, boom, open over these things. If you have, I wonder if you have your suspension lowered, could that be a complication? I don't know.